Welcome to Envision This, connecting you to visionaries of a more resilient, equitable, and earth-friendly future, and one in which spiritual and human life is more closely bound together. If you have any questions or comments and are listening live, please call in during the episode to 646-652-2235. That number again is 646-652-2235. Our special guest this evening, Andrew Harvey, envisions this: the one hope for the future lies in sacred activism, the future of the deepest, the fusion of the deepest spiritual knowledge and passion with clear, wise, radical action in all the arenas of the world, inner and outer. Andrew is author of over 30 books, a religious scholar, teacher of mystic tradition. His recent book, The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, which we'll be discussing tonight, can be ordered directly from Hay House or from your local bookstore or Amazon. He is founder of the Institute for Sacred Activism and a frequent teacher on the Shift Network. So we are honored to introduce to you Andrew Harvey.
I'm delighted to be with you all. Hello, everybody out there. Lovely to be together in Sophia's web.
Thank you. We appreciate your tangential referral to our book title. Andrew, what got you so committed to learning, writing, and teaching about spirituality?
I think in a way I came to do this work. I know people say that casually, but the unfolding of my life has convinced me that whatever made me choose my life made me choose my life to dedicate itself to getting the essential messages of the mystic traditions out at this dreadful time in which they provide the only oxygen to breathe. I was born in India, so very early on I was saturated with a living, passionate, wild, holy, gorgeous, aromatic spiritual culture. And in my 20s, when I went back to India at the age of 25, I had a series of absolutely outrageous mystical experiences for which I had no preparation at all, but which convinced me that everything that I'd learned at Oxford and everything that I taught as a professor at Oxford was absolutely inessential compared to the electric knowledge that was being fed me of the inner divine self and of the divinity of the universe. I then went on a long pilgrimage into different mystical traditions, into Sufism when I lived in Paris, into Hinduism when I became the devotee of an Indian guru, into Buddhism when I worked with great Buddhist teachers to co-write the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and into the core of Christian mysticism with my great mystical father, the father of my soul, Bede Griffiths. But by then, I'd already written my first spiritual book, Return, The Journey in Ladakh, and had already decided that I would try, with whatever means I had, to attempt to convey the glorious new world that we can discover when we truly open to the divine within and the divine without. It's been the whole truth of my life to do this work, and I feel at 63 now that in a certain sense one life is over and I'm beginning another one. I have no idea what this new life is going to be, but I feel enormously excited at what lies ahead, because so many things that I've learned over these years are now more and more integrated, and I'm seeing more and more clearly, which I hope is not a fantasy, because if it is, I shall shoot myself, because
your ongoing teachings about Christ as we experience the Holy Spirit of Christ within ourselves and in the world
yes.
are quite radical. Can you share with us why you're so passionate about Christ?
Well, I was born a Christian, and I was born from a Christian family that took their Christianity very seriously and were very humble and charitable about it and extremely tolerant of the other faiths in India, because my family, although British, lived in India for 150 years. So I had that Christian foundation to my life. I also, as a young kid, used to sing in church. I had a soaring, wild, treble voice, and I can still remember the ecstasy I had singing. I also fell in love with Jesus, I think, as so many people do, as a child. He was my beloved, and I loved the stories in the Gospels. I became an atheist at 13 and became a Marxist at 14 and thought religion was absolute rubbish, and continued with that ridiculous notion until these tremendous mystical experiences changed me. I plunged into Hinduism and Buddhism and Sufism, but then when I was in my early 40s, I met a very holy, amazing Christian mystic called Father Bede Griffiths, who was probably the greatest Christian mystic with Thomas Merton of the 20th century. And through his grace and in his presence, I discovered the real radical Christ, and that moved me to my core, and it seemed to bring me back into the depths of my own childhood and back to my first love, but seen through the prism of the universal mystical tradition. I've been teaching a 9-month course on the shift for several years now called the Christ Consciousness. And yes, it is very radical, but my God, who's more radical than Jesus? Jesus is far to the left of Marx. The Jesus that's presented in the churches, this homophobic, misogynistic Jesus that's only concerned with some strange otherworldly heaven, is an absolute fiction. Jesus was the most radical of all of the teachers. The kingdom, queendom he knew was the essential message of God to us and was already present in us, is a kingdom, queendom of radical equality, radical sharing, radical trust, radical abandon to the real power of love, radical healing of the addiction to power and domination over nature. And once you discover this Jesus, who never proclaimed himself to be the unique Son of God, but always knew that he was a pioneer of a new relationship, which he wanted to share with all other beings so that they too could discover their divinity and they too could live out this sacred relationship. Once you discover that Jesus, then you can see beyond the tawdry, divisive, idiotic sometimes dogmas of the church to the essential message of Jesus, which can be put very simply: discover that the divine consciousness is your ultimate reality. Discover that its essential nature is burning, compassionate, passionate love, and put that love into radical action on every level of your life. That's it. Mm-hmm. And that is the message I believe the whole world needs to hear at this moment of devastating crisis. You don't have to hear it through Jesus, but Jesus is the most eloquent, amazing example of this love in action, the most extraordinary example of somebody who had the heroism and the chutzpah and the passion to put his whole being into the service of love. And that's why I love him. I love all the great teachers. I've written for the Tibetans, the Tibet Book of Living and Dying. I've written books on Rumi, so I'm passionate about Sufi mysticism. I love the Hindu revelation. I've written on Taoism. I've been deeply moved by the shamanic education that I've had in the last 10 years. But for me, Jesus remains the supreme teacher of humanity because of his radical focus on the real world and on healing the injustices of the real world by putting love into action. To me, this is the most complete teaching, the most challenging teaching, the most glorious teaching, and the most transformative teaching that I know. And that's why I have, in recent years, become even more impassioned by it.
You can hear your passion.
Yeah, you can. And also, I'm hearing that you're seeing Jesus as a very grounded figure.
Yes.
Powerful.
Well, he's very exalted in the sense that he knows that he is divine, as everyone is, and he knows that everyone else is divine. But he's very grounded in that he understands that knowing that you are divine is not enough. You should also understand that everyone is divine, and then you should understand how the structures of society imprison the splendor of beings, and then you should understand how these structures distort the feminine, lock the masculine in a psychotic addiction to power, and create wholesale institutions which, instead of creative truth, honoring creative truth, actually engender massive injustice. We're in a world in which we're destroying nature, in which we're annihilating wildlife, in which we're poisoning the seas because of our addiction to power. And the Jesus message is, if you continue like this, you're going to die out, take a great deal of nature with it. It's not necessary. Wake up, get in touch with the divine within, realize that the essence of that divine is love. Put that love into action on behalf of all human beings and the whole of nature and all animals. Restructure society so that these terrifying, unjust economic and political systems are transmuted into systems that truly honor and protect and cherish human beings and nature and animals, and you will see that a birth of a wholly new kind of humanity is possible on the earth. We've come to the moment in which we're either going to choose the deranged, insane, disgusting, obscene, blasphemous, totally destructive vision of the ego on crack, lusting after power and domination that we've chosen, or the Jesus vision of love in action that can birth a new humanity and a new world. As Teilhard de Chardin said, he said, we've come to the moment where humanity will have to choose between suicide and adoration. Between the suicide chosen by the ego in its pursuit of power, or the adoration known by the heart, the adoration of God and of God in nature and God in human beings and God in oneself, that leads naturally to want to engage in compassionate action on behalf of all life. And I think that's the choice facing everyone at this moment, the choice that has to be burning in all of our hearts as we watch the world fall apart, and the choice that every single spiritual teacher of whatever religion should be trying to get people to. Because for me, love doesn't mean a hill of beans until you're willing to make real sacrifices of time, of heart, of energy, of money, to realize it, to ground it. Jesus' message is a revolutionary one, which is why they killed him. If he'd just been talking about inner peace and getting in touch with your inner divine and oming and shmoming in the long grass and doing long tantric, having long tantric afternoons with the chosen beloved, they would have left him alone. But in fact, he understood that the divine isn't simply consciousness, it's consciousness in action, it's love in action. And that made him extremely dangerous to all the structures of his world, to the Romans, to the Jews, to the religious authorities, to all the ways in which women were being oppressed, and animals were being destroyed, and that makes him permanently dangerous. Trotsky talked, you remember the great Trotsky, who was Stalin's rival for power, he talked about something which he called the permanent revolution, but he interpreted it only in Marxist terms. In fact, the permanent revolution is the Christ consciousness, because what the Christ consciousness, once you get in contact with it in any way, through grace, shows you is that the role of the human being is to press himself or herself further and further so that you can be more and more effective agent of transformative change, divinely inspired transformative change. This is the key to the evolution of the new human. This is the key to preserving the world. This is the key to transforming society. This is the key to human survival. And I've called this key sacred activism, but what sacred activism essentially is Christ consciousness. But if I just said it was Christ consciousness, half the world would have turned off, because the reality is that nearly all of the great teachers of humanity, the Buddha, the Prophet, and many of the great Hindu masters have also in their own way said the same thing. And it's time to realize, as the human race, where we are facing potential extinction. What we must do, which is plunge deep into an inner transformation so as to become strong enough to do real radical outer work and join together in sacred activism to do everything we can to turn this madness around and enable the divine to help us birth out of the chaos and destruction and madness of our time a wholly new way of being and doing everything.
You also say that an activism that is not purified by profound spiritual and psychological self-awareness and rooted in divine truth, wisdom, and compassion is only going to perpetuate the problem it's trying to solve.
Well, what my message and the message of sacred activism, and I believe the message of the Christ, is actually very critical of both mystics and activists. To the mystic, as we've experienced mystics, it says it's not enough to sit on your cushion and have magnificent experiences. It's not enough to see the divine light. It's not enough to have dreams in which you're visited by the Archangel Michael. It's not enough to write long, beautiful books on inner peace. You've got to put what you learn in your inner life into action. You've got to connect the inner and the outer worlds, because in the divine they are one, and you're given the divine experiences so as to strengthen you as a human being to be the instrument of divine law and divine truth in reality. This is the message of the prophet in the Quran. This is the message of Jesus. This is the message of the great Hindu sages who created the Vedas. This is the message. And to the activist, this vision says, it's not enough to be outraged. It's not enough to be vibrant with self-righteous anger. It's not enough to protest. Those are all honorable things. What you have to do also is to go on an inner journey, and an inner journey for two reasons. If you don't take the inner journey as well as the outer one, your outer one will not be guided by the higher wisdom that can only be obtained through the inner journey. That's the first reason. The second reason is that in a world like ours, when any progress is so blocked by really nefarious, really dangerous, really violent, really retarded powers, you will burn out quickly if your being isn't being fed intravenously by divine sources, by the springs of divine strength and illumination. So both mystics and activists, as we know them, have to, I believe, go through a revolution. The good news is that if you fuse together the highest reality of the mystic, the understanding of the unity of all existence, the knowledge that the divine beloved is always with us and in us, the real practices that enable you to stay in connection and to savor that connection and to know and celebrate that connection, if you fuse that with the enormous passion for justice and for transformation of real conditions in the really agonized real world, then a new force is born. I had a vision when I was writing The Hope, which is in The Hope, and it went like this. I woke up and I saw literally in front of me, like on a screen, two rivers of fire rushing towards the distant horizon and the sea, and when they met at the horizon, exploding in an atomic explosion, but a radiant atomic explosion, an atomic explosion of 1,000,000 colors. And as I watched this amazing new force explode, I heard the words very clearly: when the river of the passion of the mystic for God meets the river of the passion of the activist for justice, when these two streams of holy fire meet, a third fire is born, and that fire is the fire of love and wisdom in action. And the truth is that we've seen what can happen, even in terrible conditions, when a being truly aligns the deeply spiritual with the wisely active. We've seen how Gandhi could, over 30 years, unseat the British Empire, the greatest empire the world's ever seen. We've seen how the Dalai Lama can keep going in impossible conditions and still inspire the Tibetan people. We've seen how Martin Luther King could prevent an appalling bloodbath in South Africa, in America. We've seen how Desmond Tutu and his great friend Mandela could prevent a terrible bloodbath by fusing together deep spirituality and radical action. And we've seen in Solidarność and in Burma with Aung San Suu Kyi how a spiritually based activism over time can not only inspire people to be heroic, but also achieve radical change. And I believe that the deepest meaning of our crisis is that it's growing so extreme and so intractable and so insoluble within current human consciousness as to force a leap into the kind of burning, passionate, compassionate consciousness of the Christ consciousness, of the true love consciousness of the divine, that will inevitably insist on a massive rehaul of all of the institutions of the world. The mother Father has had it with our fantasies of power and domination. If we continue with them, we're going to destroy ourselves and the whole of nature very soon. We now need to make a radical shift, and that radical shift has to be towards an inner experience of our radical divine nature, by whatever name we call it, and the expression of that in works of compassion and justice in every realm and in every dimension, including, of course, animals.
You are not only speaking to me and to us and to the world now on this air, but you must have been speaking in and through me earlier today. May I read quickly?
Please.
Take a minute. Something that I wrote earlier today that just beautifully corresponds to what you're saying. It's the beginning of an essay called Providential Bridges. You hear lots of people who are vibrating on a higher level quote Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. This is a deep insight, but I say that there is an even deeper and simultaneously more exalted insight. Either-or thinking is still dualistic thinking at work, segregating us into separate dueling camps.
Right.
The truth, more nearly, is this. We are human beings having a spiritual experience, and we are spiritual beings having a human experience.
I love that. You could say that divine beings have a human experience and human beings having a divine experience, and they meet in a mystery of the opposites.
Yes, and the next paragraph begins, the glorious mystery is that both perspectives coexist simultaneously.
Yes.
The manifest experiencing the unmanifest and the unmanifest experiencing the manifest.
Yes.
We exist simultaneously in the here now of space and time and in the incorporeal immortal of infinity and eternity. We are at once in the forever now, both particle and wave.
Yes, that's beautiful and that's true. We're in a unified field. And that unified field seen from one side is the embodied Godhead, nature, our bodies, and seen from the other side is the light itself. And the light and matter, body and soul, heart and mind, male and female, transcendence and immanence, interpenetrate in the mystery of the dance of opposites at every level. And it's only a vision like this that can heal the false divisions between male and female, body and soul, transcendent light and immanent matter, and prayer and action. We've got to get over these false divisions and realize that the unified field is simultaneously transcendent and immanent, simultaneously divine and material, simultaneously pure light and endless changing matter, simultaneously being and becoming. This is what the great mystics of the sacred marriage in all of the traditions understand, and it's this vision that underlies the truth, the effective, radical, passionate, wild truth of sacred activism. Because once you understand it and through grace receive it and hope through practice to become it, once you really experience this union of opposites in yourself, then you have access through grace to a wholly new level of joy, a wholly new level of energy, a wholly new level of passion, and a wholly new level of commitment to spiritually inspired radical action, because at that moment you know that the structures of society that we've created out of an ignorant vision of the world, an unhealed understanding of spirituality, and a kind of despair at ourselves.
Why do you consider an awakening to the divine feminine as an essential part of creating this marriage between the spirituality and activism?
If you conceive, as I do, the universe and everything in it in terms of a sacred marriage of opposites, then you cannot have a sacred marriage between the transcendent masculine and the transcendent feminine and the embodied masculine and the embodied feminine without a complete, absolutely reverent, awestruck, amazed, holy return of the whole divine feminine. And for several millennia now, we have denigrated the feminine, we've locked her up in a cellar and bound duct tape over her mouth, we've humiliated her, we've made out that God is just the light and that matter is inferior and sinful and soaked with illusion. This has been a catastrophe for the human race. And one of the greatest aspects of our time, one of the most powerful transformative aspects of our time, is that the divine feminine is returning in full force. She's returning not only in her glorious light aspects, what you could call the Marianic or the Sophianic aspects, the nourishing, cherishing, tender, loving aspects. She's also returning in her aspect of Kali and Black Madonna, outraged at what we're doing and prepared to shatter everything that we've created to release us from the obsessions that have created these now demonic, destructive structures that imprison us and threaten the whole of nature. So this return of the divine feminine, which I believe to be the most important spiritual movement of our time, I've written a book called The Return of the Mother, which is my manifesto for that, but there are great books out there like Awakening Shakti by Sally Kempton, The Dark Mother by, Monica Jurs, amazing work out there for 20, 30 years now to help the human race get to an authentic vision of the light and dark mother, so that the mother who is being kept in the cellar of human consciousness with duct tape over her mouth can rise up from the cellar, meet the irradiated masculine, and marry the masculine in her full radiance in all of us to empower us. What a great, great mystic called Kabir once said, and I think these four lines are the most important four lines ever written, actually, because I think they are the fully empowered description of the fully empowered divine human being whom Kabir was. He said, "My father is the absolute Godhead, and my mother is the embodied Godhead, and I am their divine child dancing for them both on their burning dance floor." That's a definitive description of what the divine human really is. Anybody who wakes up to the sacred marriage through grace understands at a cellular level that his or her origin is the divine light. All of matter is an emanation of that divine light. But also understands at a visceral cellular level that the universe, the whole universe, is his or her mother. The father is the light in the Indian system, and the mother is the irradiated energy of the light that creates everything. So to be completely human and divine, you have to know your Father as the eternal light and your Mother as the embodied Godhead. And when you do, you are born as their conscious, joyful, impassioned, energetic, illumined divine child, dancing. And I think that word is so wonderful, because it's not, you're not sitting on a cushion having wonderful experiences. You're dancing, so your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole body are involved in this ecstatic, blissful, powerful experience of union with the unified force field. You're dancing for them both in all your inner and outer actions on their burning dance floor, this extraordinary manifestation of their union that is the universe, that is life, that is human life, that is the world. I think that is the most extraordinary statement.
I said, you are truly making love.
Yes, absolutely. We're here to make love with the universe, make love with the creation in adoration, make love with the light that is behind and in the creation with adoration, to make love to green, to make love to red, to make love to music, to make love to our relationships with the animals, to make love to our friends in the heart, and to make love with our beloveds whom we've chosen in tantric union. When we've been invited to this great feast of the sacred marriage, what a horrible choice we made in choosing the awful separation of the ego and its lust for power, which leads only to destruction and death. It is a terrible tragedy when we've been offered such a glorious vision, such beauty, such power, such energy, and such hope. The ego that we've chosen can only create structures of oppression and despair. But the self that we essentially are, especially when it's interpreted in both the transcendent and the immanent, can become the gateway into an experience of evolutionary bliss and evolutionary transformation. And for that experience, we were created.
That's powerful. In what sense do you call the economic, political, spiritual world crisis that we're currently finding ourselves in an opportunity?
Well, I would go further than saying it was an opportunity. I would say it was potentially the birthing canal of a new humanity. When I was working with my great beloved friend and mentor and father, Father Bede Griffiths, he really gave me the map for the future. He was a prophet, and he was an inspired mystic, and he was the humblest and most luminous of men. And he said, Andrew, there are three possibilities for the human race now. The first is that the human race will see what it's doing, fall on its knees, beg for transformation, and be transformed. And this is most unlikely, because human beings are blind and usually change only at or after the last moment. The second opportunity is that human beings won't see what they're doing, won't care what they're doing, and will continue to do it and drive the whole world into the flames of suicidal self-destruction and take a great deal of nature with it. He said, well, there are many afternoons when I think this is directly possible. And then he smiled and his face lit up and he said, no, but there's a third possibility. And that is that the human race will go through a very, very terrible ordeal, very like the dark night experience of the mystic, go through, in fact, a global dark night, which will look like the end, seem like the end, smell like the end, feel like the end, but will in fact be the birthing ground of a new humanity that fuses together transcendence and immanence, heart and mind, masculine and feminine, prayer and action, to engender the real second coming, which will not be the return of Jesus, because Jesus has done his work, he sowed the seed, but will be the rising of the Christ consciousness, of this dynamic, active love consciousness, if you don't want to use the word Christ, in millions and millions of beings, which will be the real second coming. So this crisis is an immense opportunity in its horror and terror, for us to do three things. First of all, it is a huge bitch slap to the human ego, to the collective human ego. Here we are thinking we're so fabulously intelligent and wonderfully graced and blessed and permitted to do anything. And what have we created? We've created a death machine which we seemingly can't stop, which is polluting 95% of the seas, keeping 2 billion people living on less than a dollar a day, has destroyed 52% of wildlife in the last 40 years. Clearly, we're nuts. And this crisis is going to show us that our actions, as we know them now, from the consciousness that we are in now, are terminally insane. That's the first terrible shock. And that's a tremendous opportunity, because it's only when you're bitch slapped like that, as everybody knows from their own personal lives, really hit with the consequences of what you've done, that you ever make a total commitment to total change. The second great opportunity is that in those people who have already awakened to the extremity of this crisis and who have dedicated their lives to finding ways through, and these people include environmentalists, animal rights people, very staunch feminists, human rights people, great mystics who've been working passionately on the earth to provide paths through this madness, in these people waking up, you have the imaginal cells of the butterfly of the new humanity. They're already here. They're on the earth. A butterfly is grown like this. A caterpillar goes into a cocoon, melts down in the cocoon into a gray gunge, and in that gray gunge, imaginal cells awaken, which when they constellate, form the body of a new being, which is a butterfly which gets out of the cocoon. The people who are getting awake now, who are forging new paths, making new inventions and discoveries in science, in economics, in politics, in organic farming, in mysticism, they are the imaginal cells of a new humanity. And if you cultivate your eyes, you'll see them, and you'll be amazed at how many they are, and how vibrant they are, and how creative they are, and how their points of view are really radically linked by a passionate commitment to embodying the divine in a celebration of the whole universe as sacred, and in a celebration of action on behalf of the poor and of the creation and of the animals. This is the theme that links them all. That's the second thing. The third opportunity that this terrible situation offers is the real choice that we have. And this is a very difficult thing to put into words, but I think I can certainly try. I believe we're in an evolutionary crisis, and that what the divine is preparing for us is a next level, a quantum leap of the whole human race into a consciously divine, consciously human, embodied divine race. This leap can't be made unless we decide to end one whole set of concepts and ideas and fantasies and delusions. And what this extreme crisis makes obvious is that our previous understanding of politics, our previous understanding of economics, our previous addictions to fundamentalist interpretations of religion, our previous patriarchal mystical systems are all now bankrupt. And we need a new vision, and we need an embodied vision, and we need a vision that brings together the divine and human, deep mystical consciousness and radical action. And what this discovery makes possible is nothing less than the divinization process acting on every level in the human race. So when you see this clearly, as I have been able, through my great teachers, through beings like Bede Griffiths and, of course, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and through the grace that the Mother has given me, when you see this clearly, on the one hand, you're absolutely horrified by the state that we're in, and on the other hand, you realize that, as the Jewish sages used to say, with so much manure, there has to be a donkey. Mm-hmm. There has to be a real reason, divine reason, for so much suffering. And the divine reason, I believe, is that this suffering is destined, if only we can understand its deep evolutionary purpose, to bitch slap us awake, to get us real about what we need to do, and to give us the tools to make the transition into the next evolutionary stage. But this isn't certain. I don't believe in this being certain. I believe that we have to choose it. And if enough of us choose it, it will happen. God will give it to us if enough of us choose it. But if not enough of us choose it, then those who choose it will experience the divine life in all of this chaos, but the world will die out. And this choice is not for 50 years down the line. It's not something that people can just think about. It's a choice that all of us, you and me, need to really make now, because the time for humanity is running out. It is 1 minute to midnight. The environment is collapsing. The major scientists are talking not only of global warming being very serious, but of global warming going far faster than they imagined. Vast amounts of methane gas are being released in the heating up of the tundras, and there are some scientists, very reputable scientists, not flakes, who are saying that if the current outflow of methane gas continues, we will be extinct in 15 years. We have got to wake up. And those, it's quite clear that 90% of people are not going to wake up in time. 95% of people are not going to wake up in time. It's 2015, and you'd have thought that the world by now would be able to embrace the truth of climate change, but you have a whole party in this country, a whole Republican Party, who's denying it. But it could still be possible that the 2 or 3% who could wake up and could implement this divinization process and could become sacred activists could create a shift. We don't know. We have to gamble for it. I'm gambling for it. I've staked my life on this, and I'll continue to gamble for it until I'm dragged off stage.
Who are some of the current activists that you most admire because they're exerting this force of sacred activism? They are the imaginal selves.
Well, on the extraordinary level, on the global level, I think there are three who come immediately to mind. The first is, of course, the Dalai Lama. For me, the Dalai Lama is the supreme teacher on the planet because he combines the profoundest realization with a relentless commitment to putting compassion into action. He has preserved Tibetan culture. He's preserved the identity, the inner identity of his people. And he's been the most passionate and compassionate advocate for the environment, for human rights on every level, and for religious unity. I can't think of anybody who exemplifies the truth and the effectiveness, really, of sacred activism more than he. And he's the great teacher, I think, of how to combine a radical inner transformation with a continuing outpouring of yourself on behalf of justice and compassionate treatment of the whole creation. The second person whom I admire deeply because of my passionate love for animals is Jane Goodall. I happen to know His Holiness, thank God. I've been one of his students for many years, and Jane is a friend of mine, and I can tell you that this heroic woman in her 80s spends almost 300 days a year still taking planes, still traveling, still trying to wake people up to the horror of what's being done to animals and to the possibilities of a new relationship with animals. And she does so with such elegance and such passion and such energy at the time of life she is. And she stands for a wholly new world of love with the creation. And she stands with such deep humility and such eloquence. And of course, she's not just humble and eloquent, she's given her whole life, every ounce of her blood, to putting what she believes into practice. And I don't think anybody who's ever had the honor of hearing her or reading her books will ever be the same. The third person who's quite extraordinary, I believe, is Aung San Suu Kyi. Aung San Suu Kyi has preserved the soul of Burma in her terrible and strange and bizarre house arrest. She was able to influence the whole transformation of a culture with her inner strength. She has failed recently in not being able to stand up for the Muslim minority that's being so tragically attacked by the Buddhists, but she may change. But even if she does fail in that way, the example that she set of keeping alive the unity of Burma through her lonely but absolutely adamantine persistence. I knew her husband and her children. I've never met her, but I know what they felt about her, because at the time I met her husband before he died, he was he hadn't seen her because she was in house arrest. And I feel convinced that she's a woman of the stature of Gandhi, and I hope that she will claim that. But I know many, many extraordinary, ordinary people who are putting their money where their mouth is, their life where their passion is. I'll tell you about two. One is a man called Adam Bucko. Adam is in his 30s. Adam was going to become a monk. He was born in Poland. He came to America at 18. And he was somebody naturally drawn to contemplation, so he went off to India and had visions of being a monk in the Himalayas and gazing out across the snows and attaining nirvana and all that. He was walking down a Delhi street, and a ragged, bleeding little girl, starving, came up, gazed in his eyes, and took his hand, and he broke down sobbing and realized that his call was not to leave the world, but to enter into the world and do something for the world. He then went and lived in an AIDS refuge in the middle of a slum in Delhi, where he saw unimaginable things and helped people die. He then returned to America, and he founded an amazing foundation for homeless youth called Reciprocity Foundation. Do look it up. It's one of the most hopeful and inspiring foundations out there. And Adam Bucko's work, he wrote a book with Matthew Fox called Occupy Spirituality, is probably the leading work of his generation. He's an amazing young man who puts love into action on the streets. His God is a street God. His love is an active love. And he hasn't just written about it or talked about it. He suffered and sacrificed for it, and he continues to, and he inspires me hugely. And the other person I want to talk about is a wonderful woman called Donnelly. I first met Donnelly in Australia when she was actually involved in a mining company. I think she was a CEO or something dramatic, but she was absolutely miserable. And I plucked up the courage after a few days of staying with her in her house in Melbourne. I said, Donnelly, you're clearly miserable. Why the hell are you doing this when your great passion is for animals and you know they're being destroyed? Your passion will destroy you if you don't enact it. Remember what Jesus said in the Gospel of Thomas. That's what is struggling to get born in you, if you don't birth it, will destroy you. Well, she screamed at me and she fell on the floor and she told me I had no right to talk to her. And I said, Donnelly, I love you. I'm telling you the truth. And 3 months later, she rang me and she said, I've given up my job. I've sold my house and I've started a wildlife foundation. 3 months later, she rang me and she said, I just had the Australian government pass a law forbidding any imports of wildlife trophies, and we're going on to really start legislating in Australia against hunting. So she'd done an immense leap. But I meet people like this all the time. I'm just begging more people to turn up, because these people are the imaginal selves of the new humanity. They're not the people sitting in fancy yoga clothes on a cushion pretending to have spiritual illuminations, but going back in their expensive cars to their expensive houses with their expensive bank accounts, making love to each other over Liechtenstein. That's just old paradigm rubbish. It has nothing to do with the new. These are the people who are really taking the human race forward, and there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of them. But what we need now is a much more coherent organization, a deep philosophy that binds all of us together, training for sacred activists, which is why I started the Institute for Sacred Activism, and really getting going in a worldwide grassroots revolution of nonviolent love in action, a taking of the world to the streets, asking for the end not asking, demanding the end of nuclear proliferation, the end of economic war between the countries, the sharing of wealth, the reduction of inequality, and the creation of an environmental friendly political and economic climate and the restoration of wildlife. There are millions of people who know that this is absolutely necessary for the future of humanity, but they need to come together soon in a universal mystical vision of love in action. And that's what my life is dedicated to, because if this doesn't happen, we're finished. If it does happen, we have a chance, just a chance, of reversing some of the appalling damage that we've done and of cooperating with the evolutionary will of God to create a new world.
Powerful. How do we embrace an uncertain future that so many fear?
We embrace it through love. How do you embrace everything is uncertain? You don't know what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, neither do I. The reality of life, as you come to understand it, if you're awake at all, is that it's constant surprise. I remember once being in South Africa with my best friend, saying to him in the morning, I've never felt so well in my whole life. And in the afternoon, I had a gallbladder attack in the middle of the bush and came within an hour of dying because my whole body had been poisoned. And it was only a half-drunk Afrikaans doctor who saved my life. I didn't know what was going to happen in that morning. You don't know what's going to happen this evening. How do we embrace the uncertainty of life? We open our hearts. We ground ourselves in the peace of the divine. We do the work to uncover the divine consciousness within us that can dance in uncertainty with grace. And we go forward with our hearts blazing, our minds lucid, and our bodies healthy. And our wills committed to acts of justice and compassion. That's the only way we can embrace uncertainty. If we allow the chaos and the misery and the awful horror of this situation to paralyze us, we will be collaborating with the powers of darkness that are creating these situations, and there are powers of darkness, and we will simply die out chewing on our foie gras, drinking our Chardonnay, while the world burns itself to ash. If we take the journey into deep divine empowerment that is offered to us by the mystical traditions, especially the ones that celebrate the sacred marriage, if we realize that we're on the earth to have the most extraordinary experience of joy and being agents of love in action, if we turn up with ragged heroism together, then we will be able to not only embrace the uncertainty of this chaotic situation, but turn it into an incitation to the most massive flowings and outbursts of creativity the world has ever seen. Humanity usually makes the greatest leaps in times of very great pain and distress. Well, we've come to the greatest ordeal of our whole evolutionary history, and time will tell whether or not we just crumble or whether or not we rise to the challenge, gamble our lives away for this great evolutionary opportunity that we're being offered. If we do, miracles can happen. If we don't, we will die out. It's as simple as that in my mind.
Powerful. But could you share with us your vision of an awakened, transformed, and healed planet? What would that look like?
I think it would look like this. I think it would. What would happen is the complete toppling of this appalling capitalist economic system and the political system. That will have to go for this to be possible. And in its place, there'll be simple communities living close to the land, because that toppling of the existing industrial system will destroy the infrastructure, and that infrastructure is going to go anyway. So I see the future of humanity as interlinked small communities living off the land in simple reverence for nature, returning to the simplicity of what we had before we created this monstrous death machine. If we're lucky, we'll still have technology, but by then we'll understand that technology without love and without wisdom will only create more disasters for us. So that technology will be entirely devoted to cleaning up the destruction and to making new possibilities out of chaos. I think the new world will have very great equality between beings. There will be sharing of wealth, because we've shown, I think, by now that any alternative to our really deep socialist system of the sharing of wealth does not work. We need to help each other, share with each other, live in the joy of sharing with each other what we have. Because look at what happens when you have radical inequality like we do. You have 1% dominating everything, making all the laws, bribing all the politicians, owning all the medias, and the rest of people starving or living absolutely crazed lives, seeking for illusory satisfactions. It's a monstrous world. I think also that the new world will have a very deep equality between men and women, and that will really honor the extraordinary creativity and beauty and sacredness of women and give women their own real power for the first time and not make them have to imitate men to have any success in life. I think that the new world will have a completely new conscious covenant with the creation, in honoring all the laws of the creation, but also with animals, and really making a deep sacred apology to what we've done to animals, and in recovering our shamanic senses so that we can establish profound sacred relationships with animals and actually open ourselves up to being guided by animals. Because it's been my experience, my amazed experience, that as I've opened up to animals in love, my cats and other animals, the guidance that I've received from nature and from them has helped me live in a completely different way. So those are just a few things of the world that's potential now. And we must truly imagine it and dream it, because until you imagine it and dream it, it can't manifest. You don't dream it in a sort of silly New Age kind of way, imagining that it's enough to dream it, because it's not enough. You have to dream it, realize that it's possible that you can dream it, and then sacrifice to make it true. And that's sacred activism.
How can inspired listeners contact you and participate in co-creating such a future?
Well, I would love them if they would do me the honor. If they've been inspired by what they say, please go and read my book, The Hope, because that's what started a global movement of sacred activism, and really take it in. I've also made two tape sets, one with Marianne Williamson called Love's Manifesto, and both of us are really talking about sacred activism, and one with Carolyn Mace called The Soul's Contract, which is about all the different sacred relationships that can empower our sacred activism. So infuse yourself with this vision from these different angles and find your own way through it. Then I would say to everybody, don't look to me as the guru of sacred activism. Discover your own sacred activist by asking yourself one question. What of all the causes in the world causes me the deepest heartbreak? Really ask yourself that question again and again until you discover the one cause that drives you almost insane with grief. That'll be the cause that you're called to do something real about. Then establish what I call networks of grace. And you'll find that I go into great detail about this in the book, The Hope. Networks of grace are local groups of between 6 and 15 people who meet together, share together, pray together, and dedicate their energies and their address books and their contacts to making real radioactive mischief in their local communities dedicated to real ends. There are networks of grace all over the world. You can look at my website, networksofgrace.org, and these are the, if you like, the institutional imaginal cells of the new divine communal body. They're working, they're helping, they're making mischief. Start one and work with others to energize yourself and to pool your resources to become effective agents of change in your own communities. I have an institute called the Institute of Sacred Activism, and we're having a radical meeting in June next year where I will be teaching some of the skills necessary. So if you wish to come and be part of my institute, just look on my website, andrewharvey.net, and come. It would be wonderful to have you there, because you'll be amongst the most extraordinarily wild people in the planet, brave people turning up. You'll make amazing new friends, and you'll learn skills that I hope will give you the power and the chutzpah and the joy and the energy to really turn up at this moment. But I cannot reiterate enough this. Look, you cannot do any of this unless you understand one thing. And that is that until you find your own deepest resources and make a commitment, a real radical commitment in your heart, to put your inner divine resources into action, all the inspiration that you'll receive from the Dalai Lama or Jane Goodall or Andrew Harvey or any of the other of the teachers who are truly begging you to get real and get going, it'll still be talk. Take the first step, trembling and difficult, into real action in your own community, and take it with others that you love, and start becoming concerned in an active way, in whatever way your heart moves you to. You'll find that if you do take that first step, the divine will guide you and inspire you in ways you can't yet imagine. So many hundreds of thousands of people all over the world are finding this out. Be one of them.
Thank you. That is the most important thing, that we be who we are, that we be the healing, that we be the grace, that we be the love, that we be the action. Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. You have been wonderful, and we appreciate this very much.
And your passion is really got me caught on fire.
Thank you. It's not my passion, it's your passion, it's everybody's passion. I just am representing it for people to see their own face in this mirror. Yeah. Because I don't want to be an icon of passion for people. I want to be somebody who lives passion so infectiously that people allow themselves to be inflamed and inspired and invigorated by their own passion. Yeah. I believe everybody has passion at the core of themselves. Some people have a quiet passion, some people have a wild, noisy passion. Different passions for different temperaments, but everybody has it, and it's time for all of us to claim this holy passion that lives in us and to really step forward, knowing that God is with us and God will help us if only we help ourselves and get going.
Amen. Have a good night.
And you, God bless you. Thank you.